From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Has a display of organic peaches at a grocery store ever filled you with dread? On the one hand, they look delicious, and you might feel good buying organic. On the other hand, they sure are expensive. Today, we take a look at the natural foods debate. From a journalist who says, forget the organic movement, it's mostly hype, to a homesteader who revels in her harvest.
When tomatoes are really in for that 2 or 3 months that they're really in, I think it's sinful not to just basically trip out on tomatoes.
Also falling under saffron's spell. It's a spice that could add fire to your food and your love life. And the delicious science of fried food.
Open up the flour a little bit, put in a little bit, maybe a little bit of mozzarella with some garlic, maybe a little bit of goat cheese, something like that. Then dip it in the batter and then fry it. That's really delicious.
You won't catch Greg Kreitzer spending $4 for an organic tomato. He's a guy you might see buying a bag of Mexican mangoes from an L.A. street vendor for a dollar. Kreitzer's a contributor to USA Today and the L.A. Times. He told Steve Paulson he's fed up with the pro-organic agenda of today's celebrity chefs.
Traditionally, the role of the chef really is twofold. One is to comfort, to restore, really the root of the word restaurant is restaure. And the job of the chef was to satisfy. And what I saw was increasingly chefs aren't really interested in that. They're more interested in preaching. There was a speech given by the head of the Culinary Institute, the associate dean of the Culinary Institute, and she proclaimed to her students, it's up to us to share what the right thing is, what it means to buy immature tuna, what it means to buy perfectly looking apples, what it means to purchase food locally and to pay the real cost of growing it. Customers know what they should be growing, and they should be thinking about how the food is grown, packaged, produced, and delivered. And this is someone who's paying for dinner.
But a lot of these chefs that you're going after are, well, they're certainly advocates of the whole organic foods movement and growing local food and buying from local growers. They are also very into tasty food. I mean, they would say that those things go together. You grow local food and you'll get better tasting food.
I'm not saying that they don't have something to say. I'm saying that I think their dogma is misplaced. And that is to say, you know, if someone wants to pay $100 for a meal of organic food and he can afford it, fine. But what the chefs have done have kind of ratcheted up another level. And they have used this, what I call this dogma, organic dogma, whatever you want to call it, to influence public policy. And I give a couple examples in one of the essays I've written recently. There's a movement called the Garden and Schoolyard Movement, really, which was founded by Alice Waters, who was really sort of the head of the organic chefs movement, if you want to call it that. And the notion was that you could bring to inner city schools a gardening class, essentially, show them where food literally comes from, that, you know, it doesn't come from McDonald's, which seems, you know, like a pretty good thing to do.
Sounds like a great idea to me.
Yeah, I think it is. But what's happened is it's become a forum, you know, for what I consider unreasonable and really kind of unsubstantiated claims about organic food. So we have a group in L.A., it works out of a local college called the Urban and Environmental Policy Institute. And what they did was they got some funding from a couple local foundations and from the school board to run a farmer's market salad bar in a couple of inner city public schools. Well, that was great. But then they started telling kids, and this is a quote, that they should prioritize organic. These are relatively low-income kids, kids from working-class families, and that really the only safe, nutritious, and conscionable food to eat is organic. And I find that, you know, tremendously, I mean, not just elitist, but just twisted in a very deep, deep way.
Is it mainly because of the cost? I mean, we all know that buying organic food at the supermarket, at least, is going to cost more than buying lots of packaged food.
Yeah, I think cost is clearly, I mean, you're talking about a price multiple, I think, of at least threefold on a good day, usually four, five, sixfold. But price really isn't the only thing. My feeling is that if you want to propagate, you know, an alternative kind of food agenda, particularly to people who can't afford it, that your science should be pretty strong. And clearly, there's really four claims to organic. particularly as articulated by the chefs. One is that it's more nutritious, secondly, that it's more tasty, third, that it's safer, and lastly, that it's environmentally beneficial, or at least less harmful than traditional agriculture. Of those four claims, only the last has some science to it. Okay, the notion that it's more nutritious, that it's safer, or that it tastes better, really has nothing to do with whether or not it's organic or not. It has to do with what time it's picked, and it has to do with the way in which it's picked.
Well, let's talk about the question of safety for a moment, because there's enormous concern about pesticides, and we know that lots of foods, from strawberries to potatoes to all kinds of things, are laced with pesticides when they're grown. I mean, obviously, depending on where they are grown. And a lot of people are talking about problems associated with toxins. And, I mean, I know some
not
of this
scientists,
is...
Not scientists.
Well,
I mean,
it depends.
If you want
it
to talk about
on...
dietary residues, okay, uh-huh. I'm not talking about spraying it on people. I'm talking about dietary residues, which is the principal claim of organics, okay? We don't have any dietary residues on our fruits and vegetables, okay? That's what part of what justifies you paying $4 a pound for tomatoes rather than a dollar, okay? There is no science. There has never been a single case of poisoning from excess dietary residues in 50 years of toxicology. So that, I think, that is one of the great victories of marketing in the organic movement, is to convince people that they should be somehow afraid of dietary residues.
What about the people who've pointed to the higher infertility rates these days and linked them to toxins? I know this is controversial, but it is out there.
Again, I mean, I don't want to beat this dead horse, but you're not talking about dietary residues. You're talking about other ways that chemicals get into and surround our body. In fact, the Center for Disease Control finally released a study on this in which they looked at metabolites in the human body. And I'm sure you know metabolite is what happens to an exposure to a chemical in the bloodstream. So you can tell if Joe has been exposed to chemical A, B, or C. It's not because the chemical is in Joe's body. It's because there is a metabolite of the chemical. And when they conducted these studies, they were surprised, A, that the levels of exposure were far lower than they had ever thought, and B, these are the first baseline data on metabolites of chemicals in the human bloodstream. And this baseline is much lower than anyone had ever thought. This was the first serious scientific study, and as I said, it pointed to much lower levels than anyone had ever thought. Like I say, I spent about 6 months reading the toxicology on this, and if you're talking about paying $4 for an organic tomato because, you know, it doesn't have dietary residues, you're spending a lot of money.
Let me follow up for a moment on the question of the virtue of foods being grown locally, which is kind of a rallying cry among large sectors of the organic foods movement. I mean, the argument there is that it's a lot better for the environment not to have to truck those foods from one end of the country to the other. I mean, for one thing, the fossil fuels that are used to do that are enormous. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, again, I mean, I think it really comes down to who is being advised to pay for this, okay? I mean, if you want to talk about wealthy Westsiders at the Santa Monica Farmers Market underwriting local produce, great. If you're, however, going to, you know, really use it as kind of a public policy and public health statement, then I think there are a whole range of things having to do with affordability of food. And the question is whether or not, indeed, a person should be discouraged, really, from eating cheap fruits and vegetables based on what you've just talked about, kind of the economic cost of transporting it. I think that, you know, then you get into a very much more fundamental debate about globalism and about trade. People have traded food since time immemorial. I mean, it's always been, I mean, that's why, you know, pepper from, you know, Ceylon costs so much money.
One thing I've noticed where I live is that the organic food stores certainly charge a lot more for produce than the ordinary supermarket. But we also have a huge farmer's market on Saturdays, and it has wonderful food there. And it's a lot of it is relatively cheap, and it's very fresh. Do you see anything wrong with that?
No, of course not. I mean, I do go. I know many, many of the farmers at my local farmer's market. I grow some of my own food. You know, I don't have any qualms with that. I guess what I am most concerned about is, let's look at the farmer's market, okay? What is cheap is what is in abundance, am I correct?
Right.
And so we buy relatively inexpensive tomatoes for the summer months, but you know, we want them in February. We want them in January. I don't see anything fundamentally morally flawed with that. But someone like Alice Waters would tell you, yes, no, you're wrong. You're morally wrong to want to consume tomatoes in February because they're not in season, and you're going to end up buying tomatoes that were raised in Mexico in who knows what kind of toxic conditions and who knows what kind of environmentally deleterious ways, and therefore you shouldn't consume that tomato. And I think that goes a long way away from kind of the, I think the most people have some common sense about food.
So you would prefer chefs to basically go back to the kitchen and just fix good, tasty food and forget about politics?
I don't care if they, I mean, obviously, man, this is the United States, so you can't shut anybody up. And that's what's wonderful about it in a way. But I would like to see the chef go back to the supermarket. I interviewed Alice Waters, who, by the way, I mean, I know that my essays were quite antagonistic towards her, but she and I got along quite well. But I asked her, when was the last time you were in a supermarket? And she looked at me like I was from, you know, Planet X. And I said, you know, she said, why would I ever go there? And I said, well, that's where most people go still, you know. And she says, well, I have no use for it. And I really repeated that question to a number of chefs I talked to. And I find that troubling. I'd like to see a time where we bring food back to what it really is about, which is nurturing.
Greg Kreitzer is a contributor to USA Today and the LA Times. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Joan Di Gusso doesn't need to worry about star chefs or the price of organic vegetables. She grows all her produce herself. Gusso tells her story in her memoir, This Organic Life. She told Anne Strainchamps, you don't have to live in the country to sustain yourself on homegrown food. In fact, a New York suburb will do.
Yes, I live 20 minutes north of the George Washington Bridge, and I have a piece of land 36 feet wide and about 200 feet deep, but a lot of that is house and shade, so I have about 1,000 square feet of growing space for vegetables.
And in that 1,000 square feet, you grow enough to feed yourself completely?
Well, to feed all my vegetables and many of my fruits. I don't grow any grains. I don't grow any dairy products. That little bit of meat I eat, I don't grow any animals, so obviously I'm not, quote, feeding myself, but I am not buying produce.
Well, so what does your diet look like now? What do you eat in the summer, for instance, when there must be lots growing in your garden?
Well, I eat a lot of tomatoes. I eat a lot of peppers. I eat a lot of green beans. I have broccoli. I have kale. I have sugar snap peas in the spring and the fall. I have beets. I have carrots when fall comes. I usually plant carrots deliberately so I don't have them in the summer because I don't really need them in the summer. I have so much fresh food. I eat a lot of tomatoes. When tomatoes are really in for that 2 or 3 months that they're really in, I think it's sinful not to just basically trip out on tomatoes.
And what about in the winter?
In the winter, I eat marvelously. I just made a big batch yesterday of roasted tomato sauce. All you do is put all this stuff in a pan and cook it for 40 minutes in a 400-degree oven. And it's basically tomatoes and carrots and parsley and other herbs and some balsamic vinegar roasted together and then pureed and then frozen. I will have a lot of that put away by winter. I will have a lot of potatoes in storage. I will have onions in storage. I will have sweet potatoes. I grow sweet potatoes in storage. I will have out in the garden until really, really cold weather, I will have kale. There's lots of things you can do with other than just turn up your nose and say, I don't like kale. Oh, I have spinach and salad greens in the summer, and I have spinach very early in the spring if I plant it in the fall. I have a cold frame so that I've sometimes, when I get my act together in time in the late summer to do it, I can plant in the cold frame. And I've actually picked salads in the middle of the winter when it was 10 below out of a cold frame. So
you're kidding. It was 10 below and there's lettuce growing?
Yes, it actually, the interesting thing, this was taught to me by one of the most brilliant organic farmers I know named Elliot Coleman, that lettuce can actually freeze, but if it's not exposed to a lot of extra moisture and wind, it will thaw again. And I have discovered that the lettuce in my cold frame can be absolutely rigid at night. And actually, the problem with running a cold frame is that if the sun comes out on a really cold day, you can burn everything inside unless you lift the lid because it gets really warm inside.
So what's in the middle of winter? What's a typical wintertime meal for you?
Well, one of the things I make a lot of, probably once a week, is a recipe that my husband sort of made up based on a place we used to go in California, which is a potato dish with tomatillos. And you know tomatillos, the green tomatoes that the Mexicans use? I grow
that
tomatillos.
Husky, papery shell on them.
I grow tomatillos, and I cook them, and then I freeze the tomatillo sauce in ice cube trays. So I have ice cube trays full of, I also make hot sauces, Mexican sauces, but I just have tomatillo puree. And so I use that with cumin and a little hot pepper, sometimes chorizo sausage if I have it, and I make this potato dish. I have not been eating much meat at all, not really so much for health reasons, though I think people should eat much less, but really for moral reasons. I cannot justify the American food system, particularly where meat is concerned. I just read one too many stories about how pregnant sows live over their own waist in cells so small they have to hunch up, and I just decided I couldn't deal with it.
Well, I think most people, or a lot of people, do feel that way, but it's really hard to sort of get through life having to think about where all your food comes from and then feeling bad about the animals that had to die. I mean, most of us have full-time jobs and need to cook something pretty quickly when we do need to cook, and we just don't have time to think about the morality involved in every food choice we make.
I think that's absolutely right. And I don't assume that people are going to tomorrow turn around and try to become totally moral in relation to food. I think people have to start small. Somebody asked me the other day how you start a garden, and I said you start small. I think you start small with food. One of the best ideas I ever came across was to say, spend $10 a week on something that's locally grown. Just $10 a week. Go to a farmer's market, find some way. Most places now there are farmer's markets. And if you go one of your weekend days, just take the trouble to go to find a farmer's market that's open on Saturday, make a little trip out of it, and buy $10 worth of food. It's a start. I used to do workshops with people trying to figure out what it meant, what it would mean to people to go local. Obviously, you can't grow the tropical things like tea and coffee. You can't grow a lot of the tropical seasonings, which are very lightweight, are very valuable, and really probably should be grown as export crops for tropical countries. You know, nutmeg and all those kinds of cinnamon, vanilla beans. But we can grow herb teas. It's obscene to import herb teas from China. And right now, China has set out to become the largest apple producer in the world. China, which needs every inch of cropland to feed its own people, is setting out to become the world's largest apple exporter, and it is wiping out Washington State and New York State. The competition is just fierce, and it's so sad.
But why? I mean, just to play this out, what's wrong with China growing all the apples for the world if that's what China decides to do?
What is China going to eat?
Well, China's got an awful lot of land. Surely they've got enough room to grow apples and rice and the other things they
need. China has less land per capita than any country in the world. China has very little cropland. Most of China's land is not growable on. China is really strapped for cropland.
So is that the thing? Is that the thing that bothers you most? Because, I mean, I guess what we've got now is a system where China tries to grow the apples for the world and Argentina or Britain tries to grow the beef, and the grain is all coming from someplace else. And I mean, it's all getting grown and it's all getting shipped around the world and it's all getting to people so most of us can eat.
Right. But the reality is that produce is about 90% water. So fundamentally, what we're doing is we're warming the planet, shipping cold water around the world. Things that we could mostly produce where we are, we ship from other places. The factoid, which I have no proof for, it's only used by all of us, so we call it a factoid, is that the average molecule of American food travels 2,000 miles. That's probably true. I mean, maybe it travels further now. Much of it comes by air. I used a statistic in my book about how many calories it takes, 435 fossil fuel calories, to fly a 5-calorie strawberry from California to New York. Now, given the fact that it's fossil fuel use that is killing us, I mean, we're going to burn up the planet. If anyone's not worried about the weather, they're not paying attention. My favorite recent story in the Times was a story about called America's Cheese State Fights to Stay That Way. Wisconsin, which has water-fed grass, has always been a dairy state because of that, can easily feed cattle without any irrigation, is in competition with California, which is growing cattle on alfalfa, usually raised with irrigation, to make cheese, which is a water-intensive process, in a state where all the water is overcommitted and there are real water problems. Now, that's nuts.
Joan DiGusso is the author of This Organic Life. Ann Strainchamps talked with her.
But the wild winter wind blow and blow, I'll be as warm as a July tomato. Peaches on the shelf, potatoes in the bin, supper ready, everybody come on in. Taste a little of the summer, taste a little of the summer, taste a little of the summer. My grandma put it all in jars. There's a root cellar, fruit cellar down below. You better watch your head now. Down you go, peaches on the shelf, potatoes in the bin. Supper ready, everybody come on in and taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer, taste a little of the summer. My grandma put it all in jars.
Just ahead, the secret of homemade French fries. It's all in the oil. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Admit it, I gave up on the notion of homemade French fries years ago. But after talking to Russ Parsons, I'm, well, maybe willing to give it another try. Parsons is the author of How to Read a French Fry and other intriguing tales of kitchen science. He told me homemade fries don't have to be pale and droopy. The secret's in the science of cooking with oil.
You have to start with the right potato. The potato has to be, a russet potato, a baking potato, but then it also has to be a potato of a certain specific gravity. It needs to have been dried out enough that it'll cook up really fluffy and crisp. And then you get into the entire question of the oil. And that's what I really find fascinating, and actually has more application for the home cook, because while frying French fries is really difficult at home, you know, it takes two cookings and all of that, there are other kinds of frying that people do regularly, and that there's even more that they could do. It's very easy, although I think a lot of times people have bad experiences the first time, and so they kind of drop out.
When you talk about frying food, when you talk specifically a French fry, does it matter, first of all, what kind of oil you use?
The kind of oil you use matters less than how old the oil is. There are different oils. There's a generic vegetable oil, which could come from a number of things. There's peanut oil. They heat to different ultimate temperatures. You know, when they smoke at different temperatures.
Right.
But not dramatically. Not enough, I think, that it makes that big a difference to a home cook.
But what does matter, you're suggesting, is how old the oil is. Well, I guess maybe how many times it's been used?
Right. And it's one of those things, I think, that with the first batch, people get disappointed because it doesn't look as good as it should. My advice is there's two possibilities. You have two alternatives. One of them is to do what I do, and that is put that first batch on the bottom of the platter and then cover it up with the stuff that looks better. By the time it gets to, you know, by the time the people get down to the bottom layer, they're happy anyway. The other thing that you can do, and I also do this, is I keep a bottle of oil in the refrigerator. that's been used. And if you add just as much as like a tablespoon of oil that's been fried in before to fresh oil, to a cup of fresh oil, to every cup of fresh oil, it'll fry well.
Now, what's going on here? When the oil is brand new, when you put it in there, you heat it up, why is it not as good to cook in as it will be in, well, I suppose 10 minutes from now?
Yeah, even shorter possibly. Most of the things that we fry are made up mainly of water. And when they're heated, the water comes to the surface, and it doesn't allow the oil to penetrate and come in contact with the food. As the oil changes through cooking, the oil can come in contact with the food, and it cooks better.
But there is a limit to this. You've got a kind of perfect time that can go on, I suppose, for quite a while. But then at the end, what signs are there that you've reached the useful life limit of that batch of oil?
Well, there are a couple signs. One of them is it'll smell bad. there's a kind of fishy odor to oil, an acridity to oil that is over its shall we say sell-by date.
So that's why the French fries taste like they've been mixed in with the fillet of fish?
Exactly. You know, if you're at McDonald's, maybe they were. I don't know. But that's one possible reason. That's, you know, at home, that's what you would find. The other possibility, the other thing that you should look for is you can actually tell by the size of the bubbles. When you add food to the oil, the oil becomes less sticky as the cooking progresses, and it'll start with really fine bubbles. And then when it gets to the point, because the oil is very sticky and it's holding together very well, when it gets to the end point where you need to change, you'll see that those bubbles will turn into like, they'll just be huge bubbles. That's another thing that you can look for.
Yeah. When you talk about how to read a French fry, do you have a specific thing in mind?
Yeah. A French fry that's been fried in oil that's too fresh, when you look at the French fry, it'll be pale. It may not be cooked all the way through. As the oil breaks down a little bit, or breaks down is kind of a bad term because that sounds pejorative and it's not meant to be. As the oil matures, shall we say, and these chemical compounds form that allow the oil to cook more efficiently, then you'll see that the French fries will be golden. You know, the hallmarks of a great French fry, crisp on the outside, fluffy, steamed, moist on the inside, sharp edges. And there's just that great smell and flavor that comes from really good oil.
You have a lot of recipes in here. Do you have a favorite thing that you like to fry? Is there a recipe that you're especially fond of?
You know, especially at this time of year, I really love to fry zucchini flowers. And at the farmer's markets here, they're hard to find in grocery stores, but look at farmer's markets. And especially look at farmer's markets that cater, this is a hot tip here, to Mexican populations, because they don't value the zucchini flower. I mean, that's a regular part of cooking in Mexico. And so if you go to a farmer's market, say that, you know, a yuppie market, you can pay $10 a pound for zucchini flowers. If you go to a Mexican market, they may be $1.50 or $2.
Wow.
And those are great. You can fry them. I usually use just a really simple, there's an Italian batter that's just water and flour. And it's a fairly thin batter so that you see the color of the flowers through it. I think that's really nice. You can cook them just plain, or you can fill them. You know, open up the flour a little bit, put in a little bit, maybe a little bit of mozzarella with some garlic, maybe a little bit of goat cheese, something like that. Then dip it in the batter and then fry it. That's really delicious, and it cooks really quickly.
Mm, it does sound wonderful. I went to a restaurant recently that had what looked like spinach potato chips. That surprised me, and I hadn't ever thought about frying spinach. It seems too delicate to do that, but it was delicious.
One of the things that's really popular now is frying herbs for chefs, because you get this kind of, especially with green herbs, you get these beautiful kind of jade green chips. They do that a lot with basil. And what that is when it comes right down to it, especially with thin pieces of food, frying is essentially dehydrating. It's driving off all of the moisture as quickly as possible. And so these chips are actually just kind of, it's very quickly dried herbs.
There was another recipe I came across in your book for what you call Tuscan potato chips that aren't Tuscan and aren't potato, but they are chips, I guess.
They're not even chips when you get right down to it. What it is fresh pasta dough rolled out, cut into whatever shape you want, and then deep fried. And then you sprinkle them with some salt and some rosemary. Mm-hmm. And I had these the first time at a little restaurant in Liguria. And they were just, it was so simple, and they were so delicious. They're like, they're almost compulsively edible. I still swear that if I, you know, if I was a better businessman, I'd make my million with Tuscan potato chips.
Russ Parsons makes crisp French fries, perfect hard-boiled eggs, and tender pot roast in Los Angeles, California. He's the author of How to Read a French Fry and Other Intriguing Tales of Kitchen Science.
From beans to fresh tomatoes. I like corned beef and cabbage too, but I just love potatoes. Now maybe you like buns and cake with lots of chocolate icing, but I just want potatoes fried. Now don't that sound enticing?
Fried potatoes are always on my mind. Fried potatoes, I eat them all the time.
It's a safe bet Deborah Ginsburg has served up a fair share of French fries in her career as a waitress. Ginsburg is the author of Waiting, the story of her 20 years as a server. I asked her just how crazy things can get waiting tables.
When you, and this happens so often, you come in for the shift and for dinner, and the lunch shift has done an awful job, and the kitchen's already out of everything, and the cooks are already screaming mad, and it's only 4:30, and there's a huge rush coming in, and there's several big parties. Maybe it's June, and it's dads and grads, you know, so you've got the families coming in, and they don't really want to be there, and they're all going to come in at the same time, and the hostess brings like 5 tables into your station all at once and seats them all at the same time, then looks at you and gives you a little smirk because she doesn't like you anyway because you haven't kicked back to her recently. And everybody wants a special order, and they have things on their mind that they want you to make for them, and the chef is mad at you, and so he won't do it. And shall I go on?
I'm just wondering why you continue to wait table after a night like that.
Well, the money's good, you know. The money's really good, and I supported myself and my son for many, many years, single mother, waiting on tables. And, of course, there is the thrill. There's sort of the lottery aspect to it. You never really know how much you're going to make, and it could be a bundle tonight. You just don't know. And so there's that, and you meet people, and it's not always horrendous, you know. Some nights are bad, and some nights are better, and some nights are pretty good. So it evens out in the end.
I don't think I realized until I began reading your description of what it's like to go to a restaurant from the other side that waiting tables is really kind of an art form when it's well done, isn't it?
I think so, and there's definitely an art to it, and there are people who are better at it, and these are artists and writers and actors, of course, because it's a bit of a show, and part of the art of it is how you can mold yourself and how good you are at becoming another person or adopting a different persona, and that all is part of it. And if you're not the kind of person who can do that very well, then chances are it isn't the kind of job that will appeal to you so much.
The funny thing about that is that I think everybody on hearing you talk about that recognizes it immediately, but probably hasn't thought about it. I mean, if I thought about waiting as an art form, I'd think about how difficult it is to carry all of those different plates at the same time and make sure that everybody gets their meal at the same time. What you're talking about is a whole different element. You're trying to put on a performance for the people at the table.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I worked with my sister for a long time, and my sister was really good at this. I mean, she liked having regulars, and they knew her life, and they knew my life, too. And they'd come in, and how's this, and how's that, and chat with her and fill up her section. And she used to call it, you know, it's my show. This is my show. Welcome to my show.
So how many different elements have to come together for a server to do a good job on a busy Saturday night?
It's a lot, you know. Within yourself, you need to be pretty centered, and you need to know what you're doing, and you have to be coordinated and have a lot of things going on at the same time. You need to know, you know, you've got five tables. Each one of them is at a different stage. This one doesn't want salad. This one wants drinks first, wants you to wait a while. No shrimp in that one. And you've got to time it all right. But then you've got to know, how fast is the kitchen tonight? Are they really on top of things, or are they really, they slowed up? Are they having a problem? Are they short? How's the bartender doing? Are you having a problem with him? Did you just break up with him recently and, you know, now he's mad at you, so he's not making your drinks? Your busboy, is he on vacation this evening in the kitchen eating, or is he willing actually to take out coffee and bread today? So there's a lot of coordination going on, and then the whole thing can get thrown off if you get a table that sits down and they want to have a fight. And sometimes people come in and they're like that. You know, sometimes the gods are with you and it all goes completely smoothly. And it's like a dance. Oh, I hate to get all lofty about this. When people start saying it's like a dance, it's time to get rid of them. But sometimes it is.
Or move on to the next restaurant.
Do
you actually look at all the people when they come in? When the hostess seats a party at one of the tables in your station, do you look at them and say to yourself, okay, I know what this group wants?
Oh, yeah. Now, this is what we call customer profiling in the biz. And sometimes we would have, you know, sort of a small pot going where we would throw a couple bucks in, guess what the people would be having, what they'd be eating, and, you know, whoever was closest got the money. This is when we were really bored. But waiters, servers tend to profile, you know, this kind of person is going to tip well, this kind of person isn't. We had it broken down in terms of nationality, profession, gender, all of those things. The professions were kind of fun to break down. Like, this person's got to be a neurologist, you know?
Does that mean a good tip?
No.
Oh. What kind of table is most likely to give you a good tip, do you think?
Well, first and foremost are other servers, you know, when you have your fellow waiters come in, and if they're in a restaurant, you know who they are, or they'll say, hey, I work at such and such a place, and waiters always give waiters the best service, and they're the easiest people to wait on, and they tip the best because they know the story. So aside from those people, my favorite table were always, you know, businessmen with the company credit card. Yeah, well, they're generous with other people's money, you know.
One of the things that is in this book is sort of the revelation of what goes on behind the scenes. Before we started talking on broadcast, you were telling me about meeting somebody who was a waiter at a restaurant that you go to regularly. And how do you feel when you go in there as a customer?
I try not to think about what goes on back there. Because as somebody who's worked back there for, you know, over 20 years, I know what goes on. And these are not necessarily active acts of villainy that are going on back there, you know, spitting, etc. But just the little things that happen in any busy kitchen, stuff falls and maybe it's not totally clean. And, you know, I don't know if maybe their hot water heater broke down, which would happen a lot at one of the restaurants I worked. And they, of course, just wash things with cold water, which violates about 27 health department regulations. And I know that these things happen, and they happen in every restaurant. And so when I go to a restaurant, I really try not to think about what's going on in that kitchen. Because if I did, I really wouldn't want to eat there. And I still go out to eat, and you do, and we all do, and we very seldom get ill, and even less often die from eating in restaurants. So, you know, it's sort of a leap of faith, I guess.
Deborah Ginsberg has waited tables for more than 20 years. She's the author of Waiting, The True Confessions of a Waitress. Here's some Loudon Wainwright III.
She's been on her feet nearly half the damn night, bringing you beverage and your late night bite. She remains cheerful when you're nasty and tight, makes change for a 50 in dim candlelight, ignoring the groping, hoping you might come across with a tip and sympathize with her plight. Tip that waitress. She's getting her master's, supporting her mom. Amidst the confusion, she remains cool and calm. She knows exits in case of a fire or bomb. She knows all the words to the 23rd Psalm. She handles her tray with panache and aplomb. Her brother's a Quaker. Her dad was in Nam. Tip that waitress.
Coming up, the sensual secrets of an exotic spice. Saffron isn't just for cooking.
Fair people will turn a kind of like an orange, but people of color and duskier skin will turn this wonderful glowing color.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. When their mother died, Pat Willard knew just how to comfort her brother and sister. She made them a saffron creme brulee pie. Willard is the author of Secrets of Saffron. She says, historically, saffron isn't just an exotic spice. It's also a treatment for depression and a natural aphrodisiac. She told Steve Paulson, you harvest saffron by picking out tiny threads of the spice from crocuses. And it's a labor of love.
It only grows naturally in a very small part of the world, in Persia. And so when people got the corns and tried to reproduce it in their own lands, they often didn't meet with a lot of success. But when they did, and even when they gathered it in the Near East, it takes about 50,000 of these very small flowers to get even a good pound of saffron. So it's backbreaking, horrible work. No one wants to do it. So you really have to suffer for this little thing.
You're saying that's how people picked it 2,000 years ago, and that's how they still pick it today?
They still pick it today like that, yeah. I've been hearing small rumors from people who know much more than I do that they're slowly developing the machines to go out into the fields. But by and large, it's still picked by hand because you're dealing with a very delicate little flower, and it crushes very easily. So yeah, it's still produced essentially the same way it was in ancient Persia.
You have some great stories of various people throughout history who have been drawn to saffron. Cleopatra, who apparently took baths in it.
Yes, and when I found this story, I just hooted because I was trying to figure out the PG rating for how to tell this story, because it wasn't how I found it. So I did a lot of noodling around trying to figure out how could I put this to my kids. But yeah, she was quite a sensuous woman. And one of the favorite ways of using saffron in her time was to soak in it. Soldiers used to use it, and Alexander the Great actually used it to soak aching bones and his wounds. And
so you would just dump a little bit in the bath that you were lying in?
Just a little handful. Well, Cleopatra, she was a queen. She could take armfuls of this stuff, and she used it, as she said, to prepare her body for receiving her lover. And what her thoughts behind this was that it softened her loins. So that she would, can we say that? So that she was more receptive and enjoyed herself, and probably her sweetheart enjoyed himself much more too. But what it also does is that it gives a glow to your skin. It's a powerful dye. So fair people will turn a kind of like an orange, but people of color and duskier skin will turn this wonderful glowing color from it, which doesn't hurt. So
there's a recipe you give for the queen's saffron perfume. Can you describe that?
Well, this is from my all-time favorite period in history. In Crete, the Minoan civilization, they were just these incredibly lovely people who walked around nearly naked, I think, all day because it's so hot, and were very artistic. And they left behind piles of tablets filled with perfume recipes. And the queen's recipe was a little bit of myrrh and rose petals crushed in oil, in essential oils, and then with saffron added to it, which made the perfume reddish, and they would dab this all over themselves. And as the heat of the day kept getting hotter, they would just coat their skins with it. And so I picture them walking around glistening with this and leaving this scent, you know.
And then you write that Alexander the Great had another use for it. For his hair.
His hair dye?
Yes. Yeah, which,
if you want to have blonde locks, yes. Make yourself a nice little potion of, dilute a quart of water with, I say, about, you know, 2 tablespoons of saffron and start rinsing your hair with it. You get this kind of reddish golden color. So, yeah, he must have been quite a scene.
Now, you've been talking about the sensual history of saffron, yeah, and obviously the whole notion that it's an aphrodisiac. Has anyone studied it to see if it really does have these powers?
Not that I know of, no. But certainly the historical account would pretty much, you know, confirm it. And there's these little sayings down through history of, you know, beware of the Persians because they'll seduce you with their saffron. Or in 17th century England, where they used it tremendously amount for their medicines, it became sort of like they used it for melancholy, almost like the Prozac that we use it. And one of the warnings was that if you use too much, you would become wanton. Hmm. So, sure, that's a good way of curing your melancholy. Getting a little happy there.
Now, is there any truth that you have some personal experience in the the steamier side of saffron?
Yeah, and, you know, since writing this book and sort of doing interviews, I've been trying to figure out what was it about that encounter. I don't know whether it was the saffron or I don't know. But, yeah, there was... When I thought about it again, you know, years and years later after having it a couple of years ago from a friend who made it for me, and this encounter that I had almost forgotten, I suddenly remember. It was in college, and someone who I hardly knew came over, and I was sick, and he had just been back from Alaska where he had learned to make this fish stew from Portuguese sailors, and he made me this absolutely wonderful broth filled with saffron, and I was not as chaste as I probably should have been because of it. And also, there was 2 beers involved, but it was partly, I think, it's because any good meal will make you feel receptive to lots of things. But I don't know. I would love to hear the scientific theories on how it reacts on you.
Now, I suppose part of the allure of saffron is how rare it is. It's only grown in this small part of the world, and it takes an incredible amount of time to harvest it. And is saffron still so prized today?
It is in certain countries, and certainly by people who cook. I think a lot of people who aren't familiar with it are afraid to use it. It's kind of a strange ingredient where you can't just add it to whatever you're cooking. So they're a little afraid of it. But for people who know and for countries who are familiar with it, yes, it's still very much revered.
How would you describe saffron's flavor?
Well, if you use just a little bit of it, it's a very subtle, very earthy flavor. It doesn't taste like dirt, but it definitely has this warm sensibility to it. Then if you use a little bit too much, it becomes very medicinal, and it tastes very closely like iodine with a very sharp metal taste, which doesn't sound very good at all, but the trick is using just enough, and then you get this warm, lovely fire almost. The sad part of it is that because it continues to be so difficult to produce, it's dying out because people, as modern technology comes into other countries, they find easier ways to make a living. So it's sort of disappearing.
What kinds of foods does it tend to get used in?
Well, it tends to get used in very bland food and to heighten it a little bit. So, of course, rice. It makes rice not only beautiful to look at, but it gives it just a slight more sharpness. Fish, of course, again, almost for the same reasons. It lends itself a beautiful color and just sharpens things. It's wonderful with eggs and in custards. And there's this wonderful preparation that I just have with saffron ice cream, which has been around for a couple of years. Hmm. But you wouldn't think it would be good, but it's quite lovely.
In any particular flavor, or that is the flavor?
That is the flavor. Yeah, that is the flavor. And as one of the great ways to use it is almost like a barbecue rub. Just slather it on like a piece of lamb or beef and put it over the coals, and it forms this crust that's incredibly addictive.
Now, given how rare it is, can you actually grow your own saffron?
You can, and it is truly a labor of love. You really have to want to do this and be a good gardener. I mean, it's not that hard to grow, except after about the third season, then it doesn't really produce well. But then to go on and harvest it, you're pretty much a slave to this little flower for about a month because it blooms on consecutive days, and you have to run out as soon as it blooms and pick them. And then after you pick the bloom, you have to, right at that moment, just get the threads because they truly just melt. And if you don't do it right away, then you're losing all the potency.
And then what do you do with the threads?
Then you dry them. And you have to be very careful to dry them well, because if you don't, it will spoil the whole jar. So when I did it, it was about a week of solid work, and I truly did nothing else. People thought I was crazy, and I was, you know, going out all hours of the day to pick it and then coming back and drying it on my table, and, you know, I was a mess. I was not a good person to be around.
And how much did you actually harvest from those saffron plants?
Well, about 3 tablespoons out of about 600 corns. So you really have to be dedicated. I don't think I'd ever do it again.
That saffron Willard harvested, it was just enough for a grand dinner party. Pat Willard spoke with Steve Paulson about her new book, Secrets of Saffron. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Doug Gordon, with engineering help from Marv Nunn and Kirill Wheeler. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Food Fights, number 92B.
PRI, Public Radio International.